So, Bill, the title of today's program, Poolside Research. Are you excited? Did you bring your trunks?
I actually brought that and some copper tone.
Okay, that's good. And you didn't...
Did I get the memo wrong?
You didn't shave anything funny in your back hair, did you? Because I did. I put Poolside Research.
The name
research.
Of a whale back
oh,
there.
Okay.
Actually, Elizabeth Taylor's name.
Okay, too soon. Too soon. All right, so today our guest is Alistair Dove from the Georgia Aquarium. Did I pronounce that right, Alistair?
You did.
Or do we call you Al?
You can call me Al.
Big Al. You can call me Al. Okay, it's a great tune. We should actually open with that one. And we're going to be talking about sort of aquariums, the history of aquariums as a research tool, which is more or less how they started. Is that correct, Al?
Yeah, that's about right. It's a long and interesting history that starts back in the Victorian days. And so I'm going to touch a little bit on the history of aquariums and the kind of research that we're doing these days.
Okay, and we'll specifically talk about some of the research going on at the Georgia Aquarium,
cool.
Things that involve parasites. That's a collaboration with the University of Georgia, and the biology of whale sharks, which is involved in a collaboration with Georgia Tech, correct?
That is correct.
You had to include Sarah Palin if you had parasite studies.
Okay, I thought you were going to make a whale joke there.
Okay.
I'm glad you didn't. All right, so we'll be having a whale of a good time when we talk about Poolside Research and the Georgia Aquarium. Okay. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
On the Electric Boogaloo, we play funk every Thursday from 11 p.m. to midnight. What is funk? Well, if you have to ask, you should probably just tune in, see if it sort of defies description. Funk can be jazz, it can be blues, it can be R&B, it can be country, it can be gospel, it can be black, it can be white, it can be Latino, Asian, African. It spans generations, continents, and ideologies. And the Electric Boogaloo funnels it all down into a 60-minute time span, each and every Thursday night from 11 p.m. to midnight, right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta, and streaming live at WREK.org.
WREK Atlanta， 为什么我们叫五十磅大米呢？因为我们播放的是最正宗、最纯正、最完全的亚洲音乐，纯亚洲音乐。所以 50 pounds of rice， 所以你感兴趣的话，每周一6点到7点，我们不见不散。Every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this kid down? Now if I did go.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ledevis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever effervescent co-host, a man who uses Hildebrand's solution theory to calculate how many Weight Watchers starch equivalents he's allowed for lunch, Bill Hunt.
Man, I'm going to have to think about that for a while. I don't even understand that one.
I mean,
okay.
You know, so if you're on these diets, right,
yeah.
You get so many starch equivalents, protein equivalents,
yeah, what is
things
Hildebrand,
like that.
Hildebrand
solution theory. Do you know what it is? It's a fancy theory for like dissolves like.
Okay.
Yet another example of how sometimes science is a little confusing,
okay.
When in fact we can present it a heck of a lot, in a more simple fashion.
So that's one of those where I don't know whether to be insulted or complimented. I just got no idea. I don't know enough.
Well, you should simply say you had nothing to do. You knew nothing about equivalent starches because you would never have to go on a diet, Bill.
No, thanks.
Despite the fact I can feel your gravitational pull from 3 feet away.
Right.
So as we mentioned in the promo, today's title is Poolside Research. We're going to be talking with Alistair Dove from the Georgia Aquarium. He is a senior scientist at the Georgia Aquarium, and he is responsible for administering collaborative research with our partner institutions. He also serves as the manager of the Veterinary Sciences Laboratory there. And received his, correct me if I'm wrong, PhD from University of Queensland, Australia. Correct?
That is correct.
Where his research focused on the ecology of parasites infecting invasive fish species in Australian lakes and rivers. He moved to the United States in 2000, where he first started as the curator of aquatic animal health at the New York Aquarium in Coney Island, which just sounds way cool.
It was quite a change from suburban Australia, I can tell you that.
Right, and I'm sure you're going to tell us a little bit more about the interesting challenges you faced at the aquarium.
Well, they feed them hot dogs. There.
That's what I'm thinking. Did you actually cultivate fish you could live on?
Yeah. It's right down the road from Nathan, so yeah, we used to go down there and get our hot dogs and take a ride on the cyclone and then go back to work.
Yeah. Oh, wow, okay. You didn't like bring the fish with you there, did you?
No.
Okay, well, that's good to know. But you actually spent some time in... what is it, in academia? You, let me get this right here, spent 5 years as a marine science professor at both Cornell University and Stony Brook University?
That's right. It's the research branch of the State University of New York.
At Stony Brook.
Stony Brook, okay. Long Island.
That is good to know. And where you did all sorts of interesting things on the health of coastal marine life. Lobsters, right.
Yeah, there's a rule in marine science. You have to work on things that taste good.
Man.
Yeah, let me write that one down.
I love lobster now. And that's like the squid. The earliest neuroscience experiments were on squid axons. So you have a little calamari at the end of the day.
But yeah, so you actually 30s. Worked on lobsters, striped bass, bluefish, and clams. Wow, that sounds like
lunch.
Good meal.
It sounds like lunch, yeah.
It's paella.
Yeah.
All right, that's good.
He's here all week, folks.
So then you joined the Georgia Aquarium in 2006 and have been working on a number of things, one of which we're going to hear about is the biology of whale sharks. And that's a collaboration you have with, Julia Kubanik?
Julia Kubanik, actually a cast of dozens over here at Georgia Tech. So there's a lot of stuff going on with whale sharks at the aquarium. So there's plenty to keep us interested.
Wow, so that's great. Okay, so let's begin the program as we often do with...
Science in the news.
Dateline Texas, ladies and gentlemen. This from a WebMD Health News article by Kathleen Doheny. Watermelon, a natural Viagra. Did you know that, Bill?
Indirectly.
I don't really want to know what that means, but researchers say popular summer fruit may have Viagra-like effect on blood vessels. And the only reason I bring this up is because I've been listening to the radio, I've been driving the car, and there's a company that makes pills that concentrate the important amino acid in the rind of watermelons, which is arginine, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing's kind of silly, right? Mm-hmm. And it's silly for a number of reasons, because first of all, why not just take arginine? And arginine can actually be metabolized into nitric oxide, which is a natural vasodilator.
And metabolized means when you consume it, that's what your body does, is enzymatically converts it to
nitric oxide. Any one of the class of nitric oxide synthases will actually do that. And the point is, that's why people take nitroglycerin. Right, nitroglycerin in large amounts is relatively unstable.
That will blow up.
It will blow up because one will, decompose, and that's enough energy to get the next one, and the next one, it's really bad. But in small concentrations, it can actually be metabolized into nitric oxide. Mm-hmm. It opens up the blood vessels, and it, puts less stress on the heart. So you get rid of this ischemic pain that, is angina, basically.
Right.
So it's kind of silly to be buying these pills.
You're
very well behaved. Even our guest is laughing and thinking,
Taylor,
I should jump in, but,
angina, Viagra, I'm just going to steer clear of all these
really
things.
Really what it says is...
she died today, by the way.
We did hear that.
Yeah.
Is there relevance to science on that one?
Will be in a few minutes, I suspect.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to touch that one. But in any case, what it points out is, and we did this. Didn't we do a show a number of years ago on erectile dysfunction medication? In general, it is a set of vasodilators. That's really what it is.
So all the natural things. Study of your behavior.
Was it really? Okay, thanks for throwing that in there, Bill. I definitely appreciate that. We did actually do a program on number 4 of phosphodiesterase inhibitors, which have a similar effect. But in general, that's all they are. So obviously nitric oxide works the same way. Arginine can be used to make that in the body. So it only makes sense. So it's silly to go out and buy these things. But what it does say is if you're on nitroglycerin for angina pain, big bonus there.
Yeah.
All right, Alistair, I'm throwing that out there for you.
So he's not going to go for the joke.
Okay, so but just remember that sometimes you take a secondary effect and make it sound as though it's something truly unique and new in science. Mm-hmm. It's just not. It's something you can get from your normal diet or a dietary supplement.
Right.
Anyway,
yep.
So now on to aquariums. Okay, what are you making? Just a weird thing?
No, that's a phone. All so right, if so anybody wants to call in, 404-894-2468, I'll get out of your way, Pete.
Right, and
sorry.
That's if you're listening live, East Coast time, noon to 1. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. If you've got a question about aquariums or aquatic research, but let's sort of start, Alistair, with the history of aquariums. How did these things come about?
Well, that's a great question. I got really interested in that after I started working in the public aquarium world because it's sort of a history that goes back to the Enlightenment and sort of that really great awareness that people developed for natural history following out of the Age of Reason. And especially once you started to get into the Victorian era when it seemed like everybody and their brother was a naturalist and they were all going out and all the hoity-toity folks were going out having great adventures in far-flung parts of the world and bringing back new species. It was like the ultimate age of citizen science, and that was when science really turned its attention to keeping aquatic things in an aquarium setting. And So
you make a very good point there. So you're saying these people, you know, you had a lot of people in Europe who would go on the grand tour and they would collect artifacts from Egypt and Greece. They would bring back fish as well?
Well, they certainly brought back the idea of fish. And so in the sort of zoological world, I think the first people to get going with this was at the London Zoo. We probably shouldn't be surprised that it was in Europe somewhere. But it was at the London Zoo, they had what they call an aquatic vivarium. It was before the word aquarium was even invented. That didn't happen until 1854. When somebody contracted those two words together, aquatic vivarium, and made aquarium, which is the word that we use today. So aquariums are a modern concept, even though people have been keeping fish in what we would now call an aquarium since, you know, Greek classical sort of times.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
They didn't start looking at them through glass until a fair bit later. In the beginning, you just used to look through the top of the tank. It would be concrete or masonry, and, you know, it was more like what we would call a pond. We didn't do the glass thing until this sort of Victorian era where people really wanted to look at these, and they were interested in fish as something other than something that you eat, something that you put in a tank and look at. That was a whole new idea, but it was all part of that Victorian naturalist kind of ethos.
That's kind of interesting because the people that found the Grosvenors that founded or got involved in the National Geographic Society originally was probably an American offshoot of that, somewhat delayed in time. And you also have Teddy Roosevelt, who basically created the system of national parks, and it was probably part of that whole European movement of the naturalist.
Yeah, I think they flowed on together very nicely from each other. The first real aquarium, what we would call a public aquarium these days, was the one in Berlin, and that didn't open until 1869. So you were squarely into the second half of the 19th century for that. Prior to that, all the aquariums had been at zoos, but people started to say, you know what, there's enough here that we could sustain a whole institution by itself. And so the Berlin Aquarium opened, and one of their early attendees was a really cool guy called Felix Anton Dorn, German evolutionary biologist. He was a big fan of Darwin. He was really excited about, because you got to think about the zeitgeist at that time, and everyone was really into, you know, evolution and this whole radical idea that animals changed over time. And he was really inspired by what he saw at the Berlin Aquarium. But he was also kind of an entrepreneurial fella, scientist, and he thought, you know what, I want to get my science funded, and I want my science funding to be insulated from normal sources of funding variability. So, you know, why not charge people to come and have a look at my experimental animals? So he had lots of fish tanks set up for scientific purposes, and he charged the public small amounts of money to come and look at that collection. And he made himself a self-sustaining aquarium called the Stazione Zoologica. It's in Naples, Italy. Don't ask me why a German guy was building an aquarium in Naples, but he did. And that was the first time that aquariums became truly scientific institutions.
How do you spell his last name?
Dorn, D-O-H-R-N, I believe.
Okay. Interesting.
So let me just chime here and say that's the most brilliant thing I have ever heard in my entire life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, Bill and I were working on an NIH proposal last week.
Yeah.
And you jump through all these hoops, and the probability of funding is low, and they've got all these restrictions, and they want half the experiment to be done before you even submit it anyway. And you're competing against so many people. I got to say, I think it's brilliant, although I don't think folks at Georgia Tech would necessarily agree. Lou Lefton, who was our guest host last week, and we went out, we gave a workshop on the use of humorous improvisation for a regional meeting of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers and how you can use that to catalyze innovation. We funded it, by doing stand-up comedy at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And it was just enough money to pay for our trip out there. And I was thinking, wow, this is a radical idea. No, it's been around for a long time.
It has been around for a long time. You don't need to have a big federal grant to get your work done. We have a very, very interesting funding mechanism for one of our projects at the aquarium, where we've been selling silly bands to support our genome project. So that's, I mean, that's big science. Genome projects are science writ large. But you can support it with a little bit of help from a lot of different people, and doesn't have to be big federal funding to get stuff done. And it buys you a certain amount of independence from the funding treadmill, which I think most scientists will tell you is pretty grueling.
Exactly. And you've been involved in that as an academic. So, but do academics say, well, selling silly bands to afford your research doesn't seem like the right thing to do?
Well, they do, until they see the cha-ching. And then they suddenly they're all interested in the idea. And it's,
to quote the movie Back to School, it you don't seem to understand, it was a really big check.
Ironically, you use silly bands to support, you know, your genome research at an aquarium. Silly bands, the one funny thing about them, they get caught in pool filters very easily. They're banned in my neighborhood because they get caught in a pool filter.
I did not know that.
What is a silly band? Would that be like the Archies?
No. It's this little rubber band that has a shape.
Silly.
And what are the shapes? You actually knew what a silly band was. What are the shapes of your silly bands? Are they shaped like Orco, Orcus, or whatever? You know.
Well, because it's a genome project, we have an A and a C and a T and a G representing the four bases that go in DNA.
Totally nerded out.
And then, of course, the very popular one is the whale shark-shaped silly band, and then the aquarium's G-fish logo makes up the set.
Wow.
Cool.
That is totally cool. All right, so this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. We need to take a quick break here, but let's come back, talk about this amazing funding approach
and some of the research that's
going on. And some of the research that's going on here at the Georgia Aquarium. And if you've got a question or comment about anything related to aquariums, the Georgia Aquarium, aquatic research, or silly bands.
Or if you want free tickets, we'll tell you you don't get any, but you can call up anyway and ask for free tickets.
Go ahead. You're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1. Give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Do you like big band jazz? Then you love the DeSoto Hour every Saturday night at 7 on WREK. The best of the big bands and the small groups played with minimum talk on your favorite jazz station, WREK. The DeSoto Hour, Saturday nights at 7 on WREK, like we said.
Vaccines have been saving lives and preventing serious illness for centuries. Yet each year, thousands of people die, and many more are hospitalized because of infectious diseases like meningitis, whooping cough, and influenza, known as the flu, that could have been prevented by vaccination. In these tough economic times, more families must choose between health care and other critical needs. Fortunately, there is a federal government program, Vaccines for Children, which provides vaccines to children and teens at no or low cost to uninsured families and others who qualify. To learn if you are eligible for the Vaccines for Children program, call your healthcare provider or your local health department. For more information about the program or to search for your local health department by zip code, visit NACHO.org. That's NACCHO.org. Vaccines for Children, helping you keep your child healthy.
This message is brought to you by the National Association of County and City Health Officials, representing the nation's 2,800 local health departments, with support from Sanofi Pasteur.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Alistair Dove, senior scientist with the Georgia Aquarium, about all sorts of things about aquatic research. And we actually had a caller on the line.
Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested in the environment, and I was wondering if there are any ways your research has been able to help fish in captivity or anything like the trade in fish, like promote the well-being of fish and things.
Yeah, absolutely. I can think of a couple of things that we do that are along that line. One of the things, of course, to do with the whale shark program that we have is that there are, in a number of parts of the world, there are ecotourism operations that have sprung up around the places where whale sharks show up with some regularity. And one of those that we work with quite a bit is in Mexico. It's off the eastern tip of the Yucatan Peninsula. And there's a lot of folks going there to see those animals now. And we were studying that group of animals before that ecotourism, I don't want to say a fad, but before it started to really take off. And so we've been able to give some of the information that we've got about whale shark populations in that area to the Mexican government, and they turned around and made the whale shark biosphere reserve. So a protected area where this whale shark aggregation is subject to a bit more stringent control, which is necessary because otherwise people will be harassing the animals and running over them with boats and things like that.
What is ecotourism precisely?
Well, this is the idea that that there's something to see if you're interested in biology. Then you can go to a place like the Amazon rainforest and just be blown away by the biodiversity.
Or the Galapagos.
Or in this case, you can go to the eastern tip of the Yucatan, which seems to be a real nexus. There's all sorts of stuff going on there with whale sharks and manta rays and turtles and fish. It really is a beautiful and spectacular destination. And so people go there to see these animals. And it just requires a little bit of regulation because otherwise things get a little bit out of hand.
All right, great question.
There are ways to protect the animals but still have revenue from tourism.
Yes, actually, it's really funny you mentioned that because we've been getting a little bit lately into the idea of sort of market-driven conservation. So this is the idea that instead of just putting a fence around an area and saying, okay, you guys can't go there, or if you go there, you're not allowed to do this, that, or the other, it's recognizing that these resources have a financial value. They have an economic value, and then you harness that value and put it to work to help with the conservation. So we call that the payment for ecosystem services model, which is a fancy way of saying you just get people to pay to go visit this area, and then you take the revenue you get from that and you plow it back into conservation.
Do you ever throw any of the tourists into the water for the whale sharks?
Sorry, I missed the question.
Do you ever throw like any of the if Dick Cheney went down on one of these, would you like throw him to the whale sharks? Just for example.
They don't have teeth.
They
do. They have 3,000 teeth, but they're really, really, really small.
They do have dentures?
They could probably, gum him for a while.
Good. That'd be great. That'd be great.
Well, before we get onto the biology of the whale shark, which we do want to do, so this whole pay for conservation, right? It's not really a new thing. If you think about it, you go down to Florida, you dive with the manatees, same thing. I mean, they have a whole group of park rangers that basically walk around and tell my son Dylan when we're down there diving with the manatees, kid, stop molesting the manatee.
Don't taser the manatee.
Right, you have certain rules, right? You can't swim to them, you can't swim down to them, you can't grope them, although they can do that in reverse, actually. There's two brothers that live near Ginny Springs. If you're there, I got out of the boat once to make sure my anchor was planted. They get on both sides of you and go in a circle and sort of spin you around like a top. It's actually pretty funny. But yeah, so they have a lot of that. And is this something they're thinking is okay for whale sharks? Is okay if you swim next to whale sharks as long as you don't disturb them or molest them?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's limits. I don't like to see images of people on YouTube riding on whale sharks, holding onto their dorsal fins and things like that. That's pretty irresponsible. There's really nothing to be gained from that. Most of the wonder and stuff can be had from a safe arm's length distance away. And also that there are large animals, and there is a risk of if you get too close to them, that tail that sweeps back and forth through the water can do you a damage.
So have you seen the video? There's a couple of guys that got whapped by tails. I've seen that previously.
Well, they probably deserved it for getting too close. But, there are, as far as the whale shark's reaction goes, we really never see any response from them. They're clearly aware of you because you can, as you swim by or scuba by, you can see their eye tracking you as you go past. So they're watching you, but they, courtesy of their size, they have very few natural enemies in the ocean, so there's no real need for them to be,
now how big are
to
they?
Be wary of you. Well, they can be anywhere up to 35 feet length, the group that we've been working in, but they supposedly can get quite a bit bigger, although I've never seen one. There's reports of animals as big as 60 feet or more.
And how long has that species been on the planet, do we think?
Well, that's a good question. Hundreds of millions of years. I like to think about the time, when I'm bobbing off the coast of the Yucatan and I'm surrounded by whale sharks and all you hear is the quiet sort of whisper of tails and dorsal fins breaking the surface. Mm-hmm. I like to think about that happening at a time when it was dinosaurs and not tourists that were roaming the Yucatan. Catan, and it's
or when the meteor hit right there,
right before the Chicxulub impact happened, which was very, very close by where this whale shark aggregation is. So they've certainly been around in largely unchanged form for tens of millions of years.
So the nice thing is, I mean, they're big; you can't really disturb them, and they actually will be feeding when they're near the surface. So they're accessible by snorkelers and divers and things like
so
that.
So what do they eat?
So they eat a range of different planktonic things, but the thing that really, which is small creatures that float around in the ocean and can't really control their own destiny, they just float around. And in the group that we look at in Mexico, they're feeding in two different places on two different things, which is one of the things that the research that we've been doing has revealed. So in one place, there's a very productive area where there's a lot of zooplankton, and in another place, there's some fish spawning. And so they go to that place to dine on caviar for about 3 months in the middle of the summertime. So it's one of the most phenomenal biological phenomena of course, it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenon. But it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in nature, and it's just a fantastic experience to be out there among those animals.
But what's nice is, as you pointed out before, you really don't have to disturb them, right? So, for example, I think of people that like to do shark dives. Sharks, you know, they don't gather and they're not slow. So what a lot of people do that is now, my understanding, banned in the United States is they will chum the water, right? And we don't do that in the United States because they're worried it
chumming
upsets.
Chumming the water meaning?
That means basically throwing in fish guts, chopped up fish, bloody fish that will attract them, right? They freeze it. They actually make a chum-sicle, which is a very convenient way to deliver it.
Chum-sicle.
And you're there. And if you go to the Caribbean, these sharks will come right up next to you. But are they worried? Is the reason they're trying to restrict that they're very worried that this is changing the balance? It's making sharks want to come right up to tourists and say hello? Or?
Yeah, there's a certain risk there that if you sort of overdo that, they're going to become reliant on the chum for food.
Right.
It's also going to break down their natural wariness of people.
Yes.
And a certain amount of wariness is a good thing. We need the animals to you know, not wander blindly up in front of a ship or something like that. That would be a bad idea. So, you know, it's mostly, it's just not a good practice. And thankfully with the whale sharks in Mexico, you can't really do that because they're there to feed on plankton, and it would take a very big plankton chumpsicle to bring a group of whale sharks together.
Right. Oh, okay. So,
are they migratory?
They are. Actually, they do some of the most amazing long-distance migrations in the ocean, and we're just starting to learn about that now from some of the satellite tagging work that we've done in collaboration with our research partners at Moat Marine Aquarium and with Project Domino in Mexico. And they are putting out these satellite tags that record the animal's location, and then eventually after some predetermined period, the tag pops off and reports back to you via satellite where that animal's been. I love that. That's like Christmas time for scientists when you suddenly get a message from the satellite service saying, oh, we've got data for you, and that's it's just fantastic to get that information back. And so we know that group in Mexico is probably the same group that they see in Honduras and in Belize and throughout the Gulf of Mexico and in Cuba. Unfortunately, we don't really know what happens after that. We lose them after they leave the Gulf of Mexico. We think they go out through the Florida Straits, but we don't know really where they go after that. And that's one of the most amazing things about working with whale sharks is it's the biggest fish in the ocean. It's the largest member of a class of 28,000 species, and yet we don't know how many there are. We don't know where they go. They've never been seen breeding. They've never been seen giving birth. There are just lots of really fundamental questions, and it's a very exciting time to be working in an aquarium because you can have a part in answering those questions while you share it at the same time with the guests who come through the doors.
So how many whale sharks do you have at the Atlanta Aquarium?
We have four whale sharks in our Ocean Voyager exhibit, Alice, Trixie, Yushan, and Taroko, so two girls and two boys. They range between 20 and 27 feet long now, and believe it or not, at that length, they're still immature, they're still juveniles. So they're remarkable animals to work with, very placid and growing robustly and having a great time. They turn out to be quite easily trained. So we normally think about training as something that you do with dogs and possibly intelligent animals like dolphins and whales, but actually the sharks and the manta rays in our Ocean Voyager exhibit are quite well trained too. So that's a testament to the training skills.
So what do they train them to do?
Well, training is a really helpful tool just to look after an animal. So to give you an example, our manta rays in the Ocean Voyager exhibit are trained for veterinary exams. They're trained to swim into a vinyl stretcher where a veterinarian can then get in and take a blood sample from that animal, and then the animal will go on its way. So that's a much safer for animal and safer for person way of doing things. And so if you can train your animals to cooperate with you in their own care, that works really well. So training is an integral part of the animal care program, and we've got some incredibly dedicated animal care staff at the aquarium.
Could you train them to do stand-up comedy?
I don't know about that. Some of them are pretty funny looking to start with, but I don't know that
well,
they have
so
too many
Bill.
Snappy
that's
one-liners.
That's nice. I wish I could train my kids to behave that well at the pediatrician. Yeah, you know, they go kicking and screaming for that booster shot. So wow.
Well, it's amazing what you'll do for a bucket of krill. So.
All right, I don't think I'll do much
try
for
the krill.
But if you're interested in a bucket of krill or you have a question or comment about aquarium or aquarium research, by all means, give us a call if you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1 at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So I guess my next question is, so you study them in the wild, and you obviously monitor them and study them in the big, what did you call it, the ocean?
The Ocean Voyager exhibit. Yeah.
This is the one with that giant polymethylmethacrylate window. That's how tall is that thing?
It's about 30 feet tall. It's about 65 feet long. It's one of the biggest viewing windows in the world.
Yeah, and in fact, I teach polymer science, so believe it or not, some of the polymethylmethacrylate on the inside still curing. We use your window as an example when
we talk
about the theory of kinetics of polymerization.
I did not know that. The window is about 2 feet thick. I know that.
Yeah, and they have a little model of it. They show the whole thickness thing. So, but the question is, do you learn things from the ones in the wild that will help you care better for the ones in the aquarium, and do you learn things from the ones in the aquarium to help you understand the ones in the wild?
In short, absolutely. It's a very reciprocal situation. So, and actually having some whale sharks in an aquarium setting has really allowed us to really jumpstart whale shark research in a way that wasn't possible before. So we're learning things from the field setting that really help us inform how we manage our husbandry in the aquarium, and we're learning some things from the husbandry in the aquarium about how we should be managing wild whale shark populations. So a good example would be diet studies. So we can go out to the field and learn what whale sharks are eating in the field and use that to inform decisions about what we should feed them in the aquarium. And similarly, we can study their feeding behavior in the aquarium and make extrapolations to fill in the blanks of those things that we can't work out from the field, because you can't follow a whale shark 24/7 in the field, but you certainly can in an aquarium.
Mm-hmm. So for example, I mean, you observe that they eat fish eggs, they're eating caviar. But is that too expensive to think about feeding the ones in the...
Well, I mean, I guess some of ours get fish eggs in the form of the fish. We do feed them some small fish. We feed them a diverse diet of different species of krill, which is the sort mm-hmm. of plankton that they would eat in the field. And we add into that some small fish, lance fish and silver sides. And there's also a gel diet component that you can add vitamins to, and they eat that quite happily as well. So they get a very diverse diet, and it funds a very robust growth rate. They grow, 1 or 2 feet a year in the aquarium setting. So that's your biggest sign that the animal is doing well, is when they continue to grow robustly and still have a good food drive. So.
Right.
How you said they're sort of essentially teenagers now. How old are they, and when do they mature to reproductive age?
Well, we don't exactly know. That's one of the big blank questions in the aquarium. We don't know for field populations, and we don't know for the specific animals that we have in the aquarium. They do tell you when they're coming into maturity. The males have they're called claspers, but just like anything else that hits puberty, those appendages get longer and more developed when they approach maturity, and ours have not got to that point yet. So it's possible that our females are getting there, because those are the two larger animals, and they're in the high 20s in length now, in feet. But the boys will tell us when they're ready, because their claspers will begin to, they call it differentiating, but they get bigger and the ends of them turn into broccoli. It's a remarkable transformation.
So I would think you'd also get some information from the aquarium exhibit itself about interaction of different species, because in the ocean's big. You never get to see lots of diverse species next to each other. I remember I was actually diving at the Living Seas in Walt Disney World, and now you have a program where you can dive in the big tank there. I'd like to talk about that in just a little bit, but you know, you get there's an eagle ray next to a sand tiger shark, and you know, people always ask me, because I've been diving for 25 years, how many sharks have you seen? Very few, because they're very rare in the open ocean. I saw six different species of shark that I could touch right in these aquarium exhibits, and you see, how does a whale shark deal with, I don't know, the great hammerhead shark. You have two of those in there as well.
That's correct. So we have this sort of natural lab setting in the aquarium. It's like a giant mesocosm, ecologists would call a mesocosm study, where you have, a replication of what you might get in nature, but it's a bit more condensed and a bit more controlled. So you can go in. We do have a dive immersion program where guests can come and swim with the whale sharks. They do stratify the exhibit a little bit, which is to say that the whale sharks spend most of their time at the top, rather, mm-hmm. and everybody else spends most of their time at the bottom. So by snorkeling, you tend to see the whale sharks more, mm-hmm. and by scuba diving, you tend to see the other animals. And we're not satisfied with just making those anecdotal observations, so we have something we call the Whale Shark Behavioral Observation Program, or WSBOP. And WSBOP is our way of monitoring whale shark behavior. So we have a dedicated team of volunteers and staff who spend untold hours following the whale sharks from a high vantage point in the aquarium and writing down everything that they do. And then we put all those data into software that's for analyzing animal behavior. And that project is led by Dr. Matt Grober at Georgia State University. And we're able to learn about how whale sharks divide up their time and what happens when they interact with each other and with other animals in the exhibit. So those data are just starting to come out now. And we certainly see, signs of individuality in these animals. You don't want to call it personality because that's anthropomorphizing a bit, but they are very different. We have Taroko, who's our shy guy. He sort of keeps to himself and is quiet. We have Yushan, who's the sort of rebel. He swims off differently from the others, and he tends to swim very fast, and he gets very amped up when it's lunchtime. And then we have Alice, who's, we call her the spotted love bus. She's one of the big females, and she sort of barrels around the exhibit, clearing the path of everything in front of her. So they do have very independent and very individualized behaviors, and the people who work with the animals know that, but that's a far cry from making it scientific. And so we're very pleased to have this behavioral observation program that's turning those anecdotes into science and really leveraging this amazing collection into generating new knowledge. And that's a real thrill for us.
Instead of personalities, would you call it fishionalities?
I guess they'd be fish-analities, or shark-analities.
Shark-analities, yeah.
Well, so what's interesting is, and this is how science always begins, right? I mean, it's how Darwin started. You make anecdotal observations, you make enough of those, and suddenly it turns into something fundamental that we just didn't know. So very slowly but surely, you may be learning things that were not known previously, as simple as they may be, like the way they swim, the way they behave. And I've talked to some of the folks in Mark Hayes' group here who I think have actually done some diving over at the aquarium, and they tell me that when they go in to clean the big window, right, they always got two guys, right? One guy's cleaning the window, the other guy's got like a broomstick. And he's basically there, what, to poke the hammerheads?
No, not really poke them. those are the safety divers. When you're concentrating on cleaning a window, you can't be looking 360
right,
degrees.
So right.
they're there to be the eyes in the back of your head so that you can concentrate on working, and they can be there to fend off anybody who takes too much of an interest. It's actually more likely to be one of our big groupers that are very curious and tend to come over and check you out and decide whether they can fit you in their mouth or not, which of course they can't, but it won't stop them harassing you while you dive. So we have a safety diver there. It's really never been a big issue for us, but we prefer to err on the safe side because you are in their habitat and you need to be respectful of the fact that they have some capabilities.
Right. So you're less likely to fall victim to the hammerhead than you are to be mouthed in an inappropriate way by the groupers.
That's a very good description.
By the groupers.
There's the hammerheads are quite flighty, actually. They're very sort of skittish shark, but just a phenomenal animal. Watching those animals cruising around in the exhibit is a real buzz for us, and you can't see that particular species in many places, so it's a privilege to be able to take my morning coffee in front of that big window and watch these animals do their thing. And that's actually where we make a lot of those sorts of anecdotal observations, is that's just the time and the exposure that comes from managing this collection 24 hours a day. So that's a real thrill.
All right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about this topic after a quick break here. But again, if you've got a question or comment about anything related to the Georgia Aquarium or aquatic research, by all means, give us a call here at the studio. If you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1, the number 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
I feel when I play my trombone, when I play a revolution, personally.
I have a message for all you out there in Radio Land. 5446, Thursdays at 8 p.m., is your weekly escape into the world of ska. Or if dub and reggae are your thing, we want you to listen too, because we're going to play something that you are going to like. That's 5446, Thursdays at 8 p.m. on 91.1 WREK Atlanta.
Every Wednesday on WREK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m., join us on the Mobius. You'll hear the finest, most diverse mix of quality electronic music from the eclectic to the ethereal, the engaging to the exciting. The Mobius on WREK Atlanta, the home of the most unique mix of ones and zeros that your mind can process. When you want your fix of electronic mastery that you won't hear anywhere else, tune in every Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. We feature live guests from the up-and-coming local scene all the way to national and international acts. There is the theory of the Mobius. Every Wednesday on the true home of quality, diverse electronic music, WREK Atlanta, where all we do is win.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Alistair Dove, senior scientist and whale shark guru at the Georgia Aquarium, about all things aquatic and aquarium related. Once again, if you've got a question or comment about the Georgia Aquarium or the research going on at aquariums in general, give us a call at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So you have a collaboration with Julia Kobanek and the folks at Georgia Tech.
I do, actually. We have several collaborations with Georgia Tech, and it's great that we're getting to a point where we can start taking advantage of the expertise that's over here. And so we actually have multiple research collaborations with Tech, but one of the ones that's most developed at this point is a study that we have about metabolomics in whale sharks. And so that's something that wasn't possible before we had the collection
and
at the aquarium.
What is metabolomics?
What is metabolomics? Metabolomics is, there's all these fields in science these days. It's very trendy to put the word omics at the end of everything. But metabolomics is the measurement of all the small compounds in the blood, like sugars and amino acids and hormones, everything that's really not a protein, everything in the non-peptide sort of class.
And if you were working on the proteins, it would be proteomics.
That's right.
So all these metabolism related compounds.
Right. So and what you're really doing is looking at all of those at once. And there are some great techniques that have been developed over here at Georgia Tech. There's some people using NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, and that includes people like Les Gelbaum and Hanno Leeson. And then there's people who do it by mass spectrometry, like Facundo Fernandez and Mark Staszynski. And when we have collaborations with all of those folks looking at metabolism in the animals in our care. And so we can take samples that we get from the veterinary care of the animals, blood samples, and we can bring them over here to Tech. And those clever folks with those great techniques can tell us what the small compounds are in the blood. And that gives us a snapshot of the whole animal's biochemistry at once.
Well, so just a cheap plugs for the chemistry and physics nerds over here. Mm-hmm. We've actually done a couple shows on NMR. Mm-hmm. NMR is one of the things that's probably garnered 4 Nobel Prizes in its various applications. And I think we've had Haskell Beckham, who works with Les Gelbaum, talk mm-hmm. about everything from application to chemical analysis like this mm-hmm. to how water
polymers,
gets wicked
right.
in your running shirt and things mm-hmm. like that. But here it is, these geeky things like mass spectrometry and NMR being used to tell you how fish and whale sharks metabolize things.
Exactly right. And we're able, actually, those two techniques, NMR and mass spec, are really complementary. The NMR gives you some structural information about the compounds, and the mass spec gives us lists of putative compound names that we can kind of mine those lists looking for chemicals that might be good biomarkers of health and for the animals in our care. And then we can take that information back to the aquarium, improve the veterinary care, and we can also take that information to the field and start asking questions about what is the health status of wild populations of whale sharks, and that wasn't really possible before we started this collaboration with Tech. So it's really great to be able to connect the clever folks with the great techniques to this really amazing collection that we're lucky to have over at the aquarium, and to be witness to this sort of science writ large. It's kind of a really unique situation because we have this thing going with whale sharks where we are learning really fundamental aspects of their biology, like how many are there, how big do they get, and how do they reproduce, at exactly the same time as we're doing really cutting edge edge stuff with metabolomics and genomics and other things. So it's sort of a 0 to 60 or 0 to 60 situation in 5 years, since we only opened on Thanksgiving 2005. So it's been quite an accelerated development of our science program, hopefully to the benefit of whale sharks.
And what you're saying is ultimately what this may produce is the basic chem panels that they do when you go in the emergency room, right? But you'll do it for fish and whale sharks to say, look, if potassium is up or this is down, this may mean they're missing this nutrient or something like that, or this could be very serious. We need to do something immediately.
That's exactly right. So you're looking for better clinical chemistry tools, and also that informs just fundamental biology. How does the physiology of this animal work? It's very, very different from mammalian physiology. I'll give you one example. Probably the best biomarker that we've discovered so far is a vitamin B analog called homerine, and that's never been recorded in a fish before. So what it's doing in whale sharks, we don't know, but it varies in meaningful ways, and we find that compound a very, very useful indicator. It really jumps out of the analysis. Right. And so, you know, you're really discovering new things all the time. It's one of the cool things. It makes you feel like you're back in that Victorian era where everything was new.
And fundamentally new stuff. I think we've got a caller on the line. Welcome to the program. Did you have a question or comment?
I have a question. Do aquariums have legal agreements with the countries that they get the fish from? And also, do they pay money for the right to bring fish into the United States?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's a good question. So we get fish from lots of sources, and whenever possible, we like to get fish from our internal sources. So we like to breed them ourselves. And then you would look to the other members of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is our umbrella organization that manages all aquariums in the country. And we would look to sharing collections between those. And in fact, lots of species are managed not at the individual aquarium level, but at the AZA level. So the AZA manages who has what and where
they
go.
Which is the American Zoological Society?
It's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Okay.
But on those situations where we do have to go to the field to collect populations from wild populations, there's nearly always an impact study, so you want to make sure that when you take that animal out to be an ambassador for its species in an aquarium, that you're not going to have a significant impact on that population. And you always do it with the permission of the relevant authority, so you're always going to have a permit for those sorts of things. It's not done. It's no Wild West sort of situation. These things are very, very tightly controlled, and we always have to follow those sorts of regulations, and we're pleased to. And in fact, we'll usually set a higher standard than whatever statutory requirement is put on us, because we want to be doing this right. We want to be doing it safely, and we want these animals to come into our collection and be able to represent for their species, as whale sharks have. I mean, we've had over 13 million people come through the aquarium, and the vast majority of those people are never going to see a whale shark in its natural setting. So we have that opportunity while they're at the aquarium to both wow them and to use that moment as a chance to give them some educational or environmental messaging that may cause a change in behavior. They'll go away saying, wow, I really didn't know that about whale sharks, and you know, maybe I'm going to go and seek out one of these ecotourism opportunities, or maybe I'm going to think twice before I order shark fin soup when I'm out at a restaurant. You know, those sorts of things. Really, we're looking to change people's attitudes to the ocean and to the animals that live there.
Well, great question.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So it's kind of interesting because you don't always get them from out in the ocean or from a more natural source, right? Actually, some of your beluga whales originally came from places that maybe weren't so oriented toward, you know, caring for these species, improving their care, understanding how to keep them, you know, alive in both captivity and outside, right?
That's right. So from time to time, there are facilities, usually outside the more organized aquarium and zoo community, where animals find themselves in unfortunate situations. And we have a vehicle for helping those animals out. It's our 4R program, which stands for Rescue, Rehabilitation, Research, and Responsibility. And so we would take those animals and rescue them from whatever situation they were in. But the animals that you mentioned, beluga whales, there were some beluga whales in different parts of the world that aren't cared for to the same standard that we would hold. And so, you know, we can consider that an act of rescue. And we can put them into a group of people who, you know, the care that the animals get when they're at the aquarium is just phenomenal, whether it's the husbandry staff who are, you know, responsible for the day-to-day handling of the animals, the feeding of the animals, or whether it's the veterinary staff. We just have, through the Carell Center for Aquatic Animal Medicine, we have the most phenomenal veterinary hospital, and these animals get better care than most humans do. So the degree of care that they're getting in our facility is really excellent, and we're really, really proud to be a part of that.
So how do you manage all that, right? You've got veterinary care, you've got diets. everything's got a different diet, and you're just learning what the optimum diet and the optimum biomarkers to figure out whether or not the diet's optimum in whale sharks and other species. How do you manage all that without going crazy?
Well, it's we're very lucky to have as part of that center a nutritionist. So we have someone on staff whose full-time job it is to be analyzing the diets that we're feeding the animals. Oftentimes, we aren't formulating these diets de novo. That is, we're not making it up. There's empirical experience from years of animal husbandry that we know that, you know, you need to feed this species herring, squid, and capelin, for example. The question is, you know, the nutritionist then comes in and analyzes that and says, okay, well, what's the nutritional value of what you're feeding? What's missing? What trace things do we need to make sure that these animals are getting, and what physiological indicators are the vets telling us, suggest that the animal may be needing something or getting too much of something, because mm-hmm. too much is, can be just as bad as not enough. And so we're very lucky to have a nutritionist who can inform that process.
So basically what you're saying is just the feeding of the animals itself, right? Because you know the sort of the base diet, and then you're checking for various markers and things like that. Are they low in a particular salt, low in a particular amino acid, whatever it is? You need to think about supplementing those. Just feeding them is a giant science research project in and of itself.
It certainly is. And so record keeping becomes very important because we have hundreds of species in the collection. We can't be studying to the nth degree in all of the species simultaneously, but we can certainly, we do it one species at a time. I mean, we move from a project, so you'll start with studying the diets of whale sharks or the diets of beluga whales, and you'll move into greater and greater detail with those species. We've done a lot of work with diets in our Asian small-clawed otters and our California sea otter population, because it turns out that otters have some pretty unique nutritional needs. And so, you know, you move through, if an animal tells you clinically that it needs some nutritional advice, then you put the nutritionist to work to try to understand that. And the nutritionist works with the husbandry managers and the vets so that you take this sort of comprehensive team approach to tackling these problems. And the result is a happy, healthy otter or a happy, healthy whale.
Well, so basically that beluga whale you got in your basement, mm-hmm. Bill, yeah, I think mm-hmm. you're going to have to give that up under the four-hour program.
It was doing such a good job mowing the lawn.
So,
I had one question. So that you've got different tanks. Is the water in any way different, like where the spider crabs are? Is that a different mix than
right.
where the other ones are?
That's a great question. Actually, I'm really glad you asked me that, because one of my other hats at the aquarium is to work with the life support department, who are the engineers who keep the water in a state where it's optimal for life and also looking good for our guests, because there is an aesthetic component. You need the water mm-hmm. to be clear and looking great so that people can see the animals. And we have a unique challenge in Atlanta because we're 5 hours drive from the coast. So we can't pump seawater into the aquarium like a lot of aquariums do. We make our own seawater from Atlanta, tap water with synthetic sea salts added to that. And then we have a tremendous amount of engineering and chemistry expertise that's brought to bear in keeping those systems exactly where they should be. So my team in the lab does about 4,000 water quality assays a week, which is a lot more than most aquariums, because we're a recirculating system and we need to monitor the water quality very, very closely. It is possible, most of the tanks are sort of connected together and you can move water from one exhibit to another. So there are unique challenges to do with how you treat the water as it moves around the system. And within any given exhibit, you have to tailor the water chemistry to suit the biology of the animal that lives there. So, for example, you mentioned the spider crab tank. That tank is going to be running at about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's pretty cold. But our Ocean Voyager exhibit, where the whale sharks live, is 76.5. And over in our tropical diver gallery, there may be some reef tanks that are warmer than that. So there, you do tailor both the temperature, the pH, the alkalinity. There's about 16 parameters that we monitor in most of our exhibits. And we have set ranges that we want to see on all of those. And we also set up triggered alarms so that if you get a number that's out of whack, you can take corrective action and return that water to the optimal condition for that animal.
So do you almost have some of the segregation of the animals based on temperature and pH and all that? Like the spider crabs wouldn't do well in the one with the beluga whale.
Right, so you can't necessarily share water. We yes, that's exactly right. And there are other requirements too. So when you talk about the marine mammal exhibits, those are regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so there are requirements for water quality under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so we manage those exhibits separately and differently than the way we would manage the fish systems. But it's all always tailored to the needs of the animal. And there's a tremendous amount of behind-the-scenes activity that goes on. It's a remarkable engineering field feet, we have 10 million gallons of water in the building, and we filter hundreds of millions of gallons through the system in any given day. And that puts us on par with a large municipal water treatment facility. Mm. Wow. And so we've actually made friends with the people from Fulton County and Cobb County water treatment systems. And we find we have a lot in common with those folks because a lot of the engineering challenges are very similar.
So what you're actually saying is the water treatment folks and you can learn from each other.
Absolutely. Wow. They're trying to produce something that's good enough for you to drink. We're trying to produce something that's good enough for a fish to live in, and those challenges are pretty similar.
The only difference is they don't have any fish peeing in their water. That's basically
it. That's true. They don't, and they also don't have salt. So salt makes things all different at the aquarium, and so we have to be sensitive to their needs too. We can't be flushing large amounts of salt water down into the common sewer system. We don't want to do that anyway because salt is expensive, and we would rather keep the salt water inside the exhibits and work hard to keep the chemistry where we want it to be.
All right, so on that note, we've reached the end of the program where we try to address what have we learned. And we've learned so much, I'm not even sure I can cover it all, but I'm going to take a crack at it. I think what we've learned is that via an integration of science and tourism at the George Aquarium and aquariums in general, aquariums no longer the circus sideshow that we think they are. We think they're just there so you can gawk at fish. But in fact, you have to have an integration of the scientific research just to keep the animals properly cared for. And then you learn from that. And then it's complemented by stuff that you learn in the field. So it really is a big science research project.
That's the idea. And in the same way that we contracted the words aquatic vivarium to make aquarium 100 years ago, we're now contracting the education and entertainment to make edutainment. And that's really the mission that we see for the aquarium is to entertain and educate at the same time. Right. And research is part of that.
But at the same time, you actually use this tourism attraction to raise funds to do research. And I know there are a lot of our colleagues here at Georgia Tech are thinking, well, I'm not sure that seems like the right thing to do. But deep down, we're all thinking that's absolutely brilliant. And if you think about the fact that you sell silly bands, right, to, fund one of your research projects, would you rather have the profit from silly bands simply go straight to a corporate entity, or would you rather have that go to support a research project to help you care for this collection, to educate people about it? And if you think about it, they are getting educated because they're learning the various nucleotides.
That's right. It's just a different funding model for science. And people should keep in mind that the aquarium is a nonprofit. It's a 501c3 nonprofit aquarium. So, any money that we make from revenue streams like attendance gets plowed back into the education programs, the conservation programs, and the research programs. So people may come to the aquarium and say, wow, this place is really slick. You know, they must be doing all right. The truth is that's in part a legacy of the gift that we got from the Marcus Foundation at the beginning that really got the aquarium started. Mm-hmm. And what happens to the revenue these days is that it gets plowed back into the other branches of the operation that meet our mission as an educational, scientific, and entertaining facility.
And what we really learned is that this is simply the continuing legacy of aquariums. That aquariums started this way. What was it? Felix Anton Dorn.
That's correct.
Who learned to fund his research in, aquatic animals by actually charging people admission. So it's one of the few win-win situations I can think of in science, education, and, tourism and entertainment.
We like to think so, yeah. It's a pleasure to be part of it. Having been on both sides of the fence as a more orthodox academic and someone who works in an aquarium system, they're very, very different worlds, but they both have the capacity to generate a tremendous amount of new knowledge about animals and to affect change that can conserve these species so that we can keep enjoying them in the future.
All right, so if you go down and do visit the aquarium, you need to realize that admission fee is in part supporting all this interesting research that is learning what is not known now, right? I mean, you learn slowly but surely about all these things. And this integrates with a number of different research projects here at Georgia Tech and down in Mexico and things like that.
That is correct.
Wow, that was absolutely fascinating. Did we leave anything out?
I don't think so. This is great. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show here on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.